We're going to start as a subcommittee. Bart, good morning. We'll start with a subcommittee. We'll start with receiving files. So, chief executive report. Matt's here, though. Hey, Matt. Yeah, please. Good morning. All right, folks, we're starting on item 31, chief executive officer. I'm sorry. He's not here. Communications officer. Chief executive must have gotten one of those USC watches that runs backwards or something.
Good morning. Just to give you a quick overview of some updates of what's taking place in communications, one of the things we're in the process of doing is giving a facelift to our timetables. We're in the process of reprinting them. So we've updated the design, added schematic maps in more detail, and also are gearing up for including Expo as well as the Orange Line extension as we move forward. Another effort that's very serious is our bicycle safety, and so we've been producing materials and working with our safety group to emphasize bicycle safety on the Expo line. We've been producing materials that work in conjunction with the outreach efforts that they have currently going on. We've also been active in terms of trying to get out the word on America Fast Forward in terms of preparing materials and updating our web information, as well as helping get the word out electronically. Another area, this is a new thing, but this is just an update on the project of human trafficking. We've basically come up with a program that will begin with the increasing awareness on human trafficking in terms of how to recognize it, and then what we'll do is move on to other social areas in terms of, like, areas like child abandonment and suicide prevention, but basically alerting our customers how to act and behave and identify issues that face them on a daily basis. And then lastly, we are working with our 511 partners to increase awareness of the 511 service, both the web as well as the telephone information system. And
on the slide on the human trafficking, and I know Supervisor Kanabe has done a lot of work in that area also. Have you been in contact with has Metrolink been in contact with you? Because we wanted to piggyback on what you're doing.
Actually, I'm meeting with them today, so okay, I'll bring this up.
Yeah, because I think, you know, the more word we can get out on it, the better it is. I think I was one of those people that was, like a lot of people, surprised to know that L.A. is an international hub for human trafficking. It's something you always think happens somewhere else and not here. So whatever Metrolink can do to help also, we'd like to do that.
Okay, all right. Definitely.
Thank you.
And that concludes my report.
All right. Any questions, Matt? Matt, on the if I could, I know we're getting closer to locking the gates and doing that whole formal part, and I think we got a report on that a little bit later. But is there a communication plan around when we're going to start doing that?
We're actually developing right now. We're identifying all the different parts of what's entailed in locking the gates. And so as we develop the plan of implementation, we'll develop a communications plan that supports that. But it'll be pretty extensive outreach as well as, customer communications. We'll have a very strong presence when we do it. But in terms of all the details, we still have to work out Title VI issues, ADA issues. We need to make sure that operationally we can get everything into place. So, yes, there will be a campaign that accompanies it.
Hey. All right, Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll go to the chief executive officer report.
I won't go over the federal stuff that I reported on yesterday at committee. Raffi's coming up next, but Mayor may want to make some comments. I do want to report that in Washington, during the APTA conference, there was a discussion on a PTC, and it was quite a we spoke in favor of not delaying the schedule at all, and indicated that Los Angeles and other Southern California counties are not in favor of a delay. The response we got was quite volatile from the East Coast, from about Florida to about Connecticut or Massachusetts. It looks like the American Association of Railroads and APTA are developing positions in favor of some relaxation. We are negotiating with them to have that be tailored to be the local conditions of each property. Some properties have cab signals, some don't. We don't. So that's still a live issue.
On that, Art, I mean, the only You know, and by the way, I got it. We really appreciate Metrolink. Also, really appreciates the leadership you've shown on the issue too, and being a major force and making them think twice on the PTC piece. The only thing that comes close to, I think, being something that should be considered, even though we don't favor moving the date, is not a blanket exemption, but like you're talking, like, you know, if a property has to make the case to the secretary and it's like a 1-year extension and they have to get it each time, that will, I think, cause a lot of people to weigh their options and, you know, hopefully they'll choose the path we did. But a blanket exemption that means they don't have to do anything or show anything, they just get more time, isn't going to get us to the solution. And, you know, it's not easy. You know, the Metrolink board and, you know, some of my colleagues here serve on that board also made a lot of hard decisions about how to pay for it because it saves lives. So hopefully the others will come around.
We heard some talk about that, and that year-by-year delays with USDOT approval would be preferable than just a 5-year extension with no intermediate steps. So stay tuned. The secretary spoke at a different meeting about high-speed rail, and I'll just say I don't think I've ever seen a Washington official be so emphatic about a project moving forward. It was quite evident that another county, which has not been supportive of high-speed rail, consumed a great deal of support that it might otherwise have had from USDOT and the FTA. With that, I'll conclude.
Great. Appreciate that, Mr. Leahy. We're going to hold, Rafi, we're going to hold the federal till the other guy gets here. Mark. Michael, do you want to do state then? We'll split them up. We'll go ahead. Do you need Matt? Well, we have a quorum. Right. Yeah. Do you have action items on yours? I was just checking on.
I have a separate item.
Okay. Thanks, Michael. Let's talk state.
Can we do the report or just go into the bills?
No, report.
Okay.
Please.
Well, I'll be brief. Just give you an update on the budget mainly. The controller had recently issued some warnings that the state could run out of cash in March. That in the past has had has posed challenges for funding of transportation projects, but worked with the treasurer and the Department of Finance to implement some short-term borrowing, so the immediate cash pressures are off the state. That is a little bit of relief because doesn't look like the state will be taking any action until at least the May revise on the budget. Despite the concerns about the overall state's fiscal condition, the state is still looking to move forward on its bond sale program. There's a small sale in the fall, but it looks like most of the transportation issues, there's a small sale in the spring, but most of the transportation issues will be dealt with in the fall. The key thing for us is to keep the quarter mobility improvement account projects funded. These are things like the 405, which is under construction, but we're also going to begin construction on the I-5 South from the Orange County line to the 605, as well as the I-5 North from 134 up to about the 170, I believe. So those are the next big construction projects that will start their major cash drawdowns on the state. So that'll be a big priority this year. One of the key things with those projects is first to keep them on schedule. We've been partnering with Caltrans, and I should note the work that Doug Failing has been doing, as well as David Yale, to coordinate with Caltrans to both keep those projects on schedule and to keep the allocations from the CTC in place. So there's good news on that. With respect to high-speed rail, the state has had a couple of informational hearings about high-speed rail, and the next step in the process will be the issuance of a revised financial plan from the administration. The High-Speed Rail Authority has put out its business plan, which details their proposed financing strategy. The administration is reviewing that and will be preparing a more detailed request to the legislature for funding. Basically, the request to the legislature is to allocate $2.7 billion of the Proposition 1A high-speed rail bonds, and that may be modified somewhat by the administration. We've continued to advocate for investment, or what we call concurrent investment, in the blended approach, which would mean investment into the high-speed rail corridors in Los Angeles County in particular, that would support the development of high-speed rail. One of the major issues facing the legislature this year is pension reform. Starting last year, a number of very aggressive pension reform initiatives had been proposed and submitted to the Secretary of State. However, the proponents of those measures have since announced that they will not be pursuing them and they will not be pursuing reform through the initiative process. Additionally, Governor Brown has proposed a 12-point pension reform plan, and the legislature is currently considering that proposal. So really the universe that's under consideration is the governor's 12-point plan. The way the legislature has been addressing that is to form a joint committee. That committee is chaired by Assemblymember Warren Fuentani and State Senator Gloria Negrete McLeod. They have held a number of informational hearings and will be preparing a report with recommendations for legislation to consider in the process. So that'll be the next significant step with the pension reform efforts. That's a serious issue for this agency because we have a number of employees who are eligible to retire, and should the state adopt what I would call very regressive pension reform, meaning some kind of pension reform that affects not just new employees but current employees, that could affect the take-home pay of employees, it could affect their long-term benefits, and could cause an early retirement of a significant number of employees at this agency. And we're talking about employees that have a lot of experience, have contributed significantly to our agency, and it would be sad to see them go under those circumstances. And also, as you can see from the list of bills we have before you today, there are a significant number of issues before the legislature. I think this is where I apologize for bringing a large number of bills, but the deadline for bill introductions was February. We go through literally all the bills that get introduced and try and identify some of the ones that will have the most immediate impact to our agency and bring those to the board as quickly as possible. And, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my report.
Michael, thank you very much. We're going to hold for a couple minutes on the bills so we can discuss that all with both Mike Antonovich and the mayor wanted to be here for that discussion. Okay. So thank you for that. All right. Item 33. Who's got item? I'm sorry. There is no item 33. Yes, there is. It's after 55. That makes sense. Item 33, going once. Art or Paul, has somebody got item 33 on our group here, or? Okay, how about we pass on that for now? How about item 34? All right. Matt's the man today. He's
This is an update on the implementation of the $5 day pass that we put into place last August. These are preliminary results. And basically, it's kind of too early to tell in terms of the total impact because we changed a lot of variables when we introduced this. But basically, we introduced it in August 2011. We have the first 5 months of data coming in. And what we found is that monthly sales grew from $260,000 a month up to $400,000. And this is just in the day pass category. And to remind the committee, what we did is we made day passes available on board buses, and it was $6 if you did not have a tap card and $5 if you did have a tap card. The overall revenue grew from 1.65 to 2.35 million, but because we did lower the price, it was $6 down to $5, the revenue per boarding went from $1.23 down to $1.10. The reason why these are preliminary results and we're still doing an evaluation on it is because we also introduced the 30 and 7 day rolling passes at the same time. We had some programs like City Ride and ITAP cancellations. And then also it was over the holidays when we introduced it. We went into November, December. So we're still analyzing it, but these are the preliminary results. And so what we're going to continue to do is monitor the performance, and we will return back to the board later with more details and get direction in terms of continuation. So that concludes my report.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a couple questions.
Mr. Boyce?
As you are going to return with more details, there are a couple things that I'd like to see included.
We know that
the lowered rate per boarding is indicative of a reduced number of cash customers? I mean, is that is it reduced number of customers or the fact that it's gone down, the price has gone down?
That just isolates the day pass revenue. So it's just the because we lowered it from $6 to $5, the revenue per boarding. It doesn't. This does not compensate for cash. It's not total revenue. It's just day pass revenue. So it's just from lowering the rate.
Then can we tell if there's any revenue loss from cash customers who make more than the four link trips from the day pass?
It's kind of too early to tell because we've changed so many variables.
That's why I'm posing these so you'll know what we're going to be looking for.
Yes.
And then on the next report, I'd like to see a comparison of boardings and revenue from fiscal year 10, 11, and June through March of fiscal 12. Okay? Can we do that?
Okay, yeah. I'll get the detail from yes.
And if we could get details of cash, token, and day pass revenue, and then in the future, a comprehensive snapshot of all fare results so we can put the reduced pass into context.
Definitely.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Very. Mr. Chair, so
yes,
then we should include an overall revenue per boarding then figure just so we can view it in that context. Because you put your finger right on the key issue. We're always searching for the sweet spot where you get the maximum revenue with the lowest fares. And, you know, it's not as easy as it sounds to get to that point, to figure out where it is, yes.
Because everyone's is different.
Absolutely.
All right.
Do we have any public comment?
Public comment? All right, Matt, thank you. Other questions? No. All right, Matt, thanks. Oh, good. Who's doing 33 now? You didn't want to do it? They broke your arm and made you do it? What? Ouch.
We're discussing. I missed it.
No.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
I was more concerned about your arm than you're missing it.
Well, if I told you the story, it'd take too long. My name's Bob New. I'm the Interim Executive Officer of Procurement, and thank you for allowing us to be here. The purpose of 33 is to adopt some revised delegation to allow the CEO to modify contracts on a sliding scale up to $5 million per modification. And as based on the recommendations from Parsons Brinkerhoff, Manat Phelps, and industry groups such as the AGC, it's been recommended that we take a more responsive approach to issuing and resolving change orders. This board report is to modify from current $500,000 unless the board has authorized a higher limit to a proposed action of up to $1 million sliding down to greater than $100 million with percentage, if I may, individual modification limits being increased accordingly. You can see on attachment B what the sliding scale would look like. And that's...
I'm sorry. Can we get that up on the screen? Do you guys have it? You don't have it? No. All right.
I have it.
All right. Go on, Zev.
So on a contract, am I to understand this, that in a contract that exceeds $100 million, that the who would get the delegated authority? The CEO?
Up to $5 million.
Would have the authority to modify what? By $5 million.
Bob, perhaps I can help. Okay, so this is, you know, we have to come to you for contract modification authority if we exceed a change greater, if we want a change greater than $500,000. Recently on the I-405, we had to make some changes out in the field. Once we got the resolution with Getty, we had to move quickly, so we did not lose the schedule. So we had to make a change order the contractor to make a change that was greater than $500,000 and then come back to you and say, in order to hold the schedule and not hold up the traffic anymore, we went ahead and authorized this change. That's an example. When we have a large dollar project like that, we need to have the flexibility to move on these changes. So what we're proposing today is that when it's a high dollar project, we'd be allowed to modify the contract up to $5 million at the CEO's authority for a billion-dollar project, staying within the life of project budget, not exceeding the total life of project budget. It's just the contract modification authority, if that makes it clearer.
The current authority is how much?
$500,000 for a single change, no matter what the size of the contract is. So the new proposal would retain $500,000 for contracts up to and including $20 million. So it's still only $500,000, but above $20 million, we're requesting $1 million, and then greater than $100 million project contract, we're requesting $5 million. So it's a very limited number of projects that this will apply to, very limited number of contracts.
So how many times can the CEO approve a $5 million change or modification?
That's up to 10%, right?
10%.
Up to 10% of the original contract award.
No more than 10%.
Correct.
So on a billion-dollar light rail project or a $2 billion subway project, 10% is $200 million. So he'd have the authority to make $200 million worth of changes at no more than $5 million a crack?
The cumulative is 10%, sir.
Right. So we wouldn't normally...
What do you mean cumulative is 10%?
All the change orders.
If we use your example of the $100 billion,
yeah.
Excuse me, a $2 billion project, it would be 10% of that would only be limited to $2 million.
No, 20. No.
20, excuse me, 20 million.
20 million.
At $1 billion, 10% is $100 million.
Right.
I think the point with it, you were saying
that. Do we have an agreement on that?
Yes.
Yes.
Or do you want to get your slide rule out?
No, sir.
Okay. So it's $100 million.
People whispering in my ear, sorry.
I understand. So it's on $1 billion, let's make it easy, it's $100 million.
Yes, sir.
That's 20 modifications of $5 million each.
Yes, sir.
I think that's a lot. I think that's way too much. And... you know, one of the things we're getting into trouble with all over this county is too much delegated authority. And people are going to go to jail because we gave them too much delegated. I'm not talking about here, but another board that I serve on, because delegated authority was given to them. And once delegated authority is given, we kind of lose sight of it. The board's oversight responsibilities are considerably undermined as a result. And I don't have a problem with a reasonable delegation of authority, but we're going to be doing multi-billion-dollar projects here hopefully over the next decade, and that's just too much authority from my point of view. And I'd like—I don't want to make an arbitrary decision here, but I'd like maybe.
We have a week before the board meeting is next week.
Right.
Mr. Mayor, did you want to? Weigh in. I mean,
you know, when explained in the way that I think Director Yaroslavsky has done it, I think he's right. I think a 10% is high. I mean, I'm not sure. You're right. I'm not sure how we. I think what we should look at, what do other comparable agencies, I mean, that's one way. You said you don't want to do this arbitrarily. Right. We should see what other comparable agencies do, because I do believe that the CEO should have some authority. There's no question about that. First of all, you mentioned something, and I know you didn't mention this agency, but...
I'll tell you which agency I'm referring to, the Coliseum Commission.
Oh, no. Everybody can do that.
I can tell you there are others where the board gets too involved in those things.
That's right.
the
threat. And we don't want that either. So we do want the CEO to have that discretion. But, you know, when you're talking, 10% of $100 doesn't sound like a lot. Of a billion, we're talking about a lot of money here. So I think the director Yaroslavsky is correct. And I don't need a sliding rule ruler to kind of figure that one out. I think the director is correct. We should look at what other large construction agencies, agencies that are similarly situated, do, what their threshold is. We should look at other municipal governments as well, and then kind of make a decision. But so I think that makes a lot of sense, and I agree with the.
Okay, why don't we take that under advisement?
Let me let the CEO make a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the concerns being expressed.
Who kept saying, I don't want this authority?
Make that clear. I'd like to look at other large public agencies.
Yes, of course.
Right.
Comparable. Yeah.
And I think what I would like to suggest, based on this, the comments made, is we come back with maybe some kind of a structure whereas up to a certain amount, the CEO would have increased discretion with a notification to the board. Above a certain amount, the CEO would have discretion to do it, but with a requirement of ratification by the board so that we don't lose the transparency. I certainly
Perfect.
Get the idea.
That makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
It sounds good.
You want to come back in a month?
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll come back next month.
April.
Okay. We won't try to do that in a week.
No rush. Right.
There's no urgent. There's
yeah.
no project.
No.
Because I know one of the things Art was concerned about was just how it affects schedule, and that's one of the reasons for this change. But
right.
we're okay with 30 days, guys. All right. So
our concern is to get something in place before we award our next large rail project.
The problem that we have trying to move so many projects so fast is there's a dilemma that often occurs, which is more or less boils down this way. Someone will say, if we defer this a month, will the world end? The answer is almost always no. But if we're not careful, that can lead to a great deal of delay over a period of time and drive up project costs. So the trick is to develop discipline with control and transparency so that we don't have those problems. Thank you.
All right. Well, okay, and we'll revisit this in 30 days with additional information. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Good thing we hired it. Yeah. Oh, most of the time. let's go back and pick up federal report. Rafi?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have some wonderful news to report, and that is that yesterday, in a historic vote, the U.S. Senate, by a margin of 74-22, voted to adopt Senate Resolution 1813, popularly known as MAP 21, Moving Ahead for Progress for the 21st Century. The bill represents an unusual triumph of bipartisanship, a strong relationship forged between Senator Barbara Boxer, chair of the EPW committee, and her ranking member, James Inhofe. The bill includes probably the happiest part, which is Title II Division A, which is entitled America Fast Forward. This is a product of this board, a united board, led by its chairman. As I shared yesterday in this committee, we have crossed many bridges with respect to America Fast Forward. I referenced the chairman leading that bridge building with labor, leading that bridge building with business, leading that bridge building with environmental groups, leading that bridge building with major constituency groups like AASHTO and APTA. And then finally yesterday at around 10 o'clock our time, leading the bridge building and crossing that bridge with Barbara Boxer in the final vote. So it was a historic vote, and I think for America Fast Forward proponents who started this effort, all of us several years ago, a victory of a dream that we had to accelerate our highway and transit program. And you know, obviously special thanks to the board, which was united in this effort, special thanks to the chairman who led this effort, and just as a point of a personal privilege, a special thanks to our CEO, who I've enjoyed working with this initiative on, and to former Deputy Mayor Jaime de la Vega, who was a person who was the genesis of this very idea and who helped me personally along the way as we move this great idea forward. As we shared in a legislative alert 2 days ago, the bill is going to remain in the Senate. It is an open question as to what's going to occur in the House of Representatives. Currently, John Boehner has put two options before the House. One option is to bring a Senate bill that's slightly modified. Another option is to bring the five-year MICA bill before the House. Right now, it's anyone's guess as to what will happen. Currently, the House is in recess. The House will reconvene next week, and we will see at that time what will occur. In other federal news,
Rafi, before you go on that,
I just wanted to note that
Art first.
The mayor was back in D.C. a few weeks ago when I was there, and I observed the advocacy that he was doing with Mr. LaHood and of course, Ms. Boxer. All over Washington, they are talking about America Fast Forward. It is actually very impressive because there's a very wide discussion going on about what they would call the Los Angeles Villaraigosa Initiative, and it's been discussed favorably by the secretary and by the senator and many other people. I will know I saw Senator Boxer on television last night, and she was talking about America Fast Forward and TIFIA loans, and she noted that the initiative had begun in Los Angeles. Sure. So I thought that was pretty cool. So with that, Rafi.
In other federal news, we have a number of Tiger 4 grants that we're going to be pursuing as an agency. There's one project which is a bridge over Sepulveda Boulevard in Manhattan Beach. There is the Crenshaw LAX Transit Project. We're also pursuing a Tiger grant for a connection between the Red Line in North Hollywood and the Orange Line. And per our board policy, we are supporting a Tiger 4 grant for the Foothill Project. And then lastly, we've talked about authorization. The other big part of Washington, D.C. is the annual appropriations process. We were honored to be in President Obama's fiscal year 13 bill budget for approximately $81 million for our New Starch projects, $50 million for the West Side Subway, $31 million for the Regional Connector, and we're going to be working with members of the House and Senate to advance those appropriations requests. Specifically, today in the Senate, the Transportation Appropriations Subcommittee, on which Senator Dianne Feinstein serves on, is meeting to discuss the fiscal 2013 budget. And in the House of Representatives, we'll be working with our appropriators from Los Angeles County, who are Congressman Adam Schiff and Congresswoman Lucille Roybal-Allard. And with that, that concludes my remarks, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Rafi, thank you. I think you're right. You know, I can't recall it, Mr. Mayor. You know, I think that, you know, the leadership that you showed, and, you know, it's no secret that we're friends and go back a long time, but this is not about that. When you went out in 2008 and Pam O'Connor brought a motion here, and you and Zev chaired the campaign on Measure R, everyone said it couldn't be done. Worst recession in history, and we did it. And when we started going back to Washington, because you're more impatient even than I am, which as far as commuters in L.A. is going to be a good thing, people told us that it could never happen. And they said they'd never do a re-auth bill, they'd never do anything more than an extension, and they'd certainly never do anything of substance. And, you know, through the coalition that you built, along with the Conference of Mayors and Move LA and, you know, all of the business folks, the labor folks, and the environmental folks, is unprecedented. And I believe it's the first time that a mayor's initiative that I've been able to find, by the way, I think it's the first time that a mayor's initiative from a city has wound up in the title of a bill that's been voted on in the U.S. Senate. Ideas get taken, bits and pieces get taken. I've never seen, and no one can seem to remember, anything where someone took literally verbatim what you created here in 3010 and turned into AFF and winds up in the title of a bill, which will be part of transportation law in this country for a long time to come, and people will be better off for it. So that's not bad. So, Rafi, that was, you know, good work on your part and the team's part and the board's part. And, of course, we shouldn't forget the other house in back there, even though I think a lot of people try to these days. But I'm hoping the speaker – I'd be happy if the speaker just – I think we'd all be happy if the speaker just focused on the Senate bill.
Oh, thank you.
I think it would be a great place to be.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One item I did forget to mention is that we traipsed around Washington, D.C. with documents on America Fast Forward. And they're produced by our design studio, and they do a great job. This is what we were passing out last week, and folks like Michael Lejeune and Melissa Rosen in our design studio don't do good work. They do great work, and that helps us make the case for America Fast Forward more effectively. And so I'm grateful to the design studio for their efforts.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go now. Michael, let's pick up on the legislation.
Chairman and members, we have a set of bills before you. Some of these are our sponsored bills, and I'll highlight those as we go through. Generally, we identify our sponsored bills in our legislative program, but it's really just one sentence, so we like to bring the bills back when they're in print so we can give you a more thorough understanding of exactly what we're doing. So like I said, some of these are sponsored bills, and some are just bills that have been introduced, and I'll highlight those as we go through. The first bill is AB 1532, which is being carried by Speaker Pettis, and this would establish the methodology by which the cap-and-trade revenues will be allocated. We're working with the Speaker's office to develop language that would allocate a portion of the total cap-and-trade revenues to transit. As of now, the language identifies four general categories of funding, and we would look to compete in at least two of those. At this point, it looks like the language will not be formula-based, but there will be some form of a competitive program. But we're working with the Speaker's office and would want to continue to work with them, so we'd like to support that bill.
Michael, since I think we'll probably go on each bill separately, let me ask, there's one speaker, and I just want to get his comment beforehand, since I don't know which bill it is, but Fahamas, I'm sorry if I butchered that badly.
No problem. Thanks.
How is it pronounced?
Faramarz. Yes.
Faramarz.
Thank you.
And your last name is?
Nabevi.
Nabevi. Okay.
Thank you. So I'd like to speak on AB 2245, the Smythe bill exempting from CEQA certain bike projects. The organizations that I'm affiliated with, the LA County Bicycle Coalition and the Transit Coalition, both support this bill, and we're glad that Metro is supporting it as well. Also would like to note that Michael Turner and Deputy Supervisor Michael Cano are trying to work on finding a way to get a spot bill introduced so that Metro would be authorized to install three-position bike racks on buses. It is our hope that Metro Management can sit down with the UTU to figure out how to address the UTU's concerns. However, we are opposed to the request that UTU is making to essentially have a veto over which lines would get this support. Finally, I personally support AB 2405 with Bloomfield. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask a question, because I know that we weighed in on that. If the CEO, Mr. Leahy or Stater, what's happening with, we all believe that we need to promote more cyclists getting on our buses. We were looking at a lot of bus companies that you can put up to three bikes on the buses. What's happening with that?
I know that right now we're stuck on a problem because a current requirement would be that we have a committee to include union membership that would have to vote unanimously on service changes. Michael, can you elaborate?
Sure. Yeah. We were trying to get a bill introduced by the deadline that would have authorized us to put three-position bike racks. We've been working very closely with SCAG on the issue, who has really championed this along, and so we're working with them on
Everybody's
that.
Everybody's for this.
Excuse me?
Everybody's for this.
Except the unions. The unions want a route review committee if we do.
You know, come on. So. Look, we got to run an agency here. We need... Look, people can have input, but management's got to run this agency. This is good public policy. I mean, so who's, how can you be against this?
Well, the problem with the Route Review Committee is that fundamentally they get well, to...
Is this a legislative...
Yeah, what happened, the first legislation that authorized three-position bike racks was done in Alameda County. And when that legislation was done, the Alameda County agreed to this Route Review Committee with the unanimous approval. That essentially established the precedent. And so every time an issue like this comes up, the unions are, and when we proposed, and when SCAG
that's
and
the kind of stuff, I'm going to tell you something, that's the kind of stuff that just riles people. Look, people have a right to input, and we should be for that. But in the end, we got to be for good public policy. We got to take that rule on. Yeah, it's like we're going to have a vote on whether we're going to have clean buses. You know, we're going to have a vote on whether or not we're going to, you know, this city's addicted to, this county is addicted to the single passenger automobile. This is a great way to get cyclists on our buses. And you know, other agencies do it, and we've got to sit down and move ahead to make that change. I mean, I don't think anybody would disagree with that, do you?
The problem here is it's not just input. It's a committee.
That's what I'm saying. It's not just input. It's a committee that can veto it.
Okay, one person on the committee can veto it.
That's ridiculous.
He doesn't
the agency's got to make these decisions.
Sure.
Mr. Mayor, if I could jump in. The particular challenge we have right now is we need an author for our bill. And that's the main thing we need right now.
Well, let's go find one. That's your job.
Yeah.
Go find an author for the bill.
We're coordinating
work
also with
you, but go find an author for a bill.
Okay. All right, let's go through the list. Okay. We're on 1532 Perez on greenhouse reduction, and you're recommending a support position on that.
Yes.
Any problems with anybody? On support on such will be the that's the recommendation. Okay. B is 1600 Taurus. This is the Metro Gold Line extension.
AB 1600 is a bill that's being sponsored by the Foothill Construction Authority, and this would address their...
I'll be honest with you, Michael. I don't understand the recommendation. We wind up as the deep pocket on all these construction authorities, and there's, as from what I can tell, and we were talking about it earlier, there's no requirements to be made whole. There's no requirements that they stay out of Measure R money. There's no requirement. Why is this in our good best interest? I guess that's the part I don't get.
Well, like I said, it's, you know, I always say I don't have positions. The board has positions. So
recommended it.
Yes, and I did recommend it. And the reason I recommended it is because there is still a requirement in the governing statute that the authority has to develop a series of agreements with us before they can pursue the line. And those agreements include a memorandum of understanding and financing agreements that outline the funding that would be committed to the project as well as to construct the project as well as the funding to operate the project. So there are still agreements that have to be reached between us and the authority as well as decisions of this board to both fund the project and operate it.
Let me ask you a question. I'm sorry.
I guess my question is pretty simple and pretty basic. Does this mean that we end up paying for another county's project?
No, I don't know. I don't believe that this specific change does that because although the bill says that we would ultimately operate the project, they still have to identify first the funding to construct the project. And if it comes from a source over which this board has control, this board still has to vote on it. It's the same issue with the operation of the line because, for example, our long-range plan does not include funding to operate the line. So there would have to be an action of this board to amend the long-range plan and commit the funds to operate the line. So this approving their authority to essentially engage in the initial planning for the line does not commit the board to any specific funding plan.
Chair,
either constructed or operated.
There will not be Measure R money available because it will be consumed way before we get into San Bernardino. Staff will not recommend using Los Angeles money to pay for either capital or operating costs in San Bernardino. That all to be negotiated with San Bernardino. What this really establishes is a basis for that, the authority for that negotiations. Is that correct, Michael?
Yes.
Well, then I think Then I think the proponent, if the proponents of the bill agree with that, then I think there should be no objection to having a provision in the bill that says that, rather than to leave it up to 13 members of a board that we don't know who they're going to be years from now, who might decide in their infinite wisdom to spend money that L.A. County taxpayers have assessed themselves on something that is spent in San Bernardino County. First of all, the only reason for this bill, as I understand it, is to give the authority for the Gold Line Authority to operate a segment of their line that is not in Los Angeles County. Because today, the Gold Line Authority, I assume, has the authority by statute to build, and we have the authority to operate anywhere within Los Angeles County. So up to the Los Angeles County San Bernardino line, you don't need any legislation, correct?
That's correct.
So the only reason for this legislation is to give them the authority to build? Is that what it is?
Yes. Well, it's plan and construct.
For Metro to operate.
It's plan and construct, so it's both the environmental document and the construction of the project.
Okay. Well,
I think we should be at this point work with author and try and get some of the amendments in that Zev and Diane are talking about in terms of, as I said, if there's no intention to use that money, et cetera, making it clear in the enabling legislation would make sense, even though it's subject to a negotiation between the two agencies afterwards. I agree with my colleagues about, let's spell out some parameters in here before we move forward. So let's make it a work with author and
the spending of L.A. County money outside of L.A. County is off the table and should be precluded in this legislation, period, over and out. And if we can't get the author to agree to that, then we ought to oppose this thing with guns blazing.
Very well. Understood.
That would be capital and operating funds.
And yes. I'll be honest.
Capital
I'll be
and
honest.
Operating
yes.
funds.
It does ask the question about your judgment when you recommend that we support it. I mean, we expect more than that. Just like the answer, I can't find an author. Well, that's your job. You need to find an author. And, I can tell you, I'll bet you haven't even talked to the UT about all of that. On both those issues, expect a little better performance. I really do. We spend a lot of time, and there's never a time when we're asked to go to Sacramento or D.C. See, never a time when I don't use city resources, my time to do it. And every one of us are willing to do the same. But you got to talk to us. And that, Zev is right. If San Bernardino County wants to put up the resources to do that, we can talk about it. But the idea that we would just support that willy-nilly, come on. We've worked hard to build a coalition here, and it has not been easy. But we've got one. We could do a regional one, but that means everybody's got to put up. So this is a big thing. And I could see why, the director, Yaroslavsky, is hot about it because – you didn't willy-nilly just support things like this where one, you're giving the legislature authority, supporting the legislature's authority to spend our money. That's not the way it works. We've worked hard to put this together. So let's
understood.
Raise it up.
Understood.
Brief question to Charlie. If you can get us an answer to this, I'm not expecting you to answer it off the top of your head, but does the county, does Metro have the authority to spend sales tax money of any kind, Prop A, Prop C, Prop R, or any other monies that are within our control outside the county of Los Angeles?
I'll follow up on
Thank
that.
Thank you.
All right. Next bill, Michael.
The next measure is AB 1706 by Assemblymember Ng. This is one of our sponsored measures, and it deals with an issue in state law relating to vehicle weight limits. There's been some confusion about the applicability of specific weight standards in state law with respect to our buses. One of the issues, one of the major issues in the bus industry is that there have been significant changes in the bus industry, partially due to regulations, but also safety and security concerns. For example, we have to, we've been including CNG engines on our buses, which adds significantly to the weight of the vehicle. We also have various safety and security issues, such as aluminum interiors, thicker windows, for example, that contribute to the weight of the vehicles. And this has caused some level of confusion with the right. weight standards that exist in state law, so this would clarify.
This is an MTA-sponsored bill?
Yeah. It's a sponsored bill, and we have a work with author because the language just set is intent language at this point, and we've not fully fleshed out the details, and we're working with the Transit Association on that.
All right. Any objection to the support position as it's laid out? It's a work with author?
It's a work with author because the language is intent language, and we're working with the Transit Association.
Got it. So you introduced intent language to meet the deadline, and now we'll get the details.
Yes.
Okay.
AB 2147 by Assemblymember Cedillo would clarify the statutes related to Metro's photo enforcement program. There are two basic issues with this. First is that there has been some confusion in the court system about the validity of a ticket that's not personally issued by an officer.
Right.
We're trying to rectify that to declare that the tickets are valid. And then we're also looking to be able to attach the fine to the owner of the vehicle. We're having some discussion about how that would actually work. But this is one of our sponsored measures, and we're recommending support.
Okay. Any objection to supporting, sticking with the recommendation on this?
I have a question. Why would we support this? I mean, on a public policy ground, why?
Well, our photo enforcement program, was actually one of the first in the state. We have photo enforcement on the Blue Line and the Metro Orange Line, and we've seen a significant reduction in accidents after the installation of the photo enforcement program. So we believe it has contributed significantly to safety along both of those corridors. The particular issues we're trying to address, so I would say there's first the issue with the usefulness of the program, and then what we're dealing with here are two particular issues in the statute that addresses our program. The first has to do with the validity of our tickets, and there's been some concern at the court level that, and there are actually court cases on this right now, that since the tickets are not issued by an officer to a person, for example, in a normal red light violation, an officer sees the violation, pulls a person over, writes the ticket, hands them the ticket, the person signs the ticket. In this case, the system identifies the violation. There's an officer that reviews the video evidence of the violation and then signs that the ticket is valid. It's then put into the mail to the registered owner of the vehicle. The courts have been, and people have challenged the validity of the ticket based on the fact that the officer, for example, didn't have any control over the maintenance and of the actual equipment. They didn't actually see the violation in person. They're looking at a video recording of a violation. And so there has been court cases, and I understand there's actually two court cases on both sides, that challenge the validity of that process. What we're trying to say in our law is that process, the process of the officer viewing the violation and signing the ticket, is valid, and the court should consider that ticket valid. So that's issue number one. Issue number two that we're trying to address is that the tickets or the tracking of the fine is sometimes lost because you'll have issues with the owner of the vehicle and did the vehicle get sold or something along those lines. In this case, what we're trying to do is attach the fine to a registration like a parking ticket so that if somebody doesn't pay the fine on one of these violations, they couldn't re-register the vehicle the next time the registration comes up. One of the issues that's arisen with this is that somebody may have sold a car or they may have loaned the car to somebody. And so we've had some discussions about how to handle this, is that somebody needs to have a process by which they could say, I sold the car, it's no longer mine, please, this doesn't belong to me. And so
you're basically saying, the bill's basically saying that if I lend my car to my son and he runs a red light, I'm going to pay the ticket.
That would be the effect of this. And one of the concerns is, for example, there's sort of two parts to that question. One is if you've sold the car and you no longer own it, then there should be a process by which you can come to us or the issuing authority and say, I don't own this car anymore, so therefore I'm not liable for the ticket. So that's issue number one. The second issue would be what you're raising is if you loan the car to somebody. Under the mechanism we're creating right now, whoever owns the vehicle would be responsible for the fine. And so what we're looking at is, can we have a process whereby we can a person who is found to have violated a vehicle owner who has found that their vehicle violated the law, can they come to us and say, I wasn't driving the vehicle, this person was driving the vehicle, and they should be responsible for it? That's also one of the differences with a red light citation. With a red light citation, the officer is giving the ticket to the person that was driving the car, not to the vehicle. So we're trying to look at that process as well in this legislation.
So you're trying to find a process by which if I lend my car to my son and he runs a red light and I get the ticket, that I can communicate with somebody that it wasn't me, it was... So you want me to finger my son, basically.
Well, yeah. Well.
Or whoever.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a question about the owner of the vehicle having responsibility for...
Yeah. And how do I prove that? I mean, isn't that a legal issue that at that point? How do I prove that he was driving my car? If he says, I wasn't driving my car, his car, I was in school at that hour.
Yeah. Well, that's where this is. We're still working a little bit on this language, on that particular piece of it, because that's been one of the challenges with photo enforcement systems around the state. Right. So...
And what's generating this legislation is the legal challenges that have been brought to photo enforcement, Is that what prompted all of this?
Yeah, it's a combination of the legal challenges that have been brought, but when the other municipalities basically removed their photo enforcement system, our staff went back and looked at the processing of our citations, the statutes relating to it, and we've identified these changes. As well as one of the other issues we're dealing with is we've had a concern that people would see our system and think it's not in effect, and that they would basically ignore a system that's in operation. So we've been trying to also do more posting of signs, more outreach along the corridors to let people know that the system.
Well, it's had the exact opposite effect on me. I don't know which ones are in effect and which ones are not in effect, but we have a policy in our household. We assume that every one of these cameras are in effect. Because to assume that they're not in effect then rationalizes running a red light or violating some regulation. So we always take the view that all the cameras are working and that they're a good disincentive to violating the motor vehicle code. Are we about the only jurisdiction left standing that's using the photo enforcement?
I believe so.
Okay. And I believe we should, because the photo enforcement has been one of the major reasons we have reduced, practically brought to an end, the accidents we were having on the Orange Line. You remember those, the first month
right.
of operation.
Month of office.
Yeah, that's right. And now... You know, it's a rarity, and I think that's worked in. It's going to work in all of them, and I think you need to keep us posted on this. I'm not sure I understand what you, and I don't want to take any more of the time of the committee. But maybe we can discuss this later. I'm not sure I understand what this vehicle this vehicle would be for a. Registered owner of a car to opt out of paying if he can demonstrate that somebody else is driving the car, and how that gets over the legal issues that have been raised. But anyway,
yeah, I would add that's one of the reasons. I mean, this is one of our sponsored bills, and I would add that's one of the reasons I like to bring them back to the board is because in our legislative program we basically have one sentence that says what we're going to do, and we've been spending our time developing some of this language and putting things together. So I think it's always important to bring it back to the board.
Yeah.
To have this kind of discussion. So.
The other thing, while we're just talking about safety in these rail crossings and busway crossings and the like. I think one of the other main reasons why we have brought accidents down to a minimum is your Department of Transportation using the no right turn red arrow, which just totally changed the psychology of the driving public, because we have, as Woody Allen once said, the great cultural contribution Los Angeles has made to the nation is you can make a right turn on a red light. And that was creating a good percentage of our accidents on the Orange Line were happening because people were making right turns into the busway. And the red arrow has, you know, just a simple little thing, has saved countless accidents and who knows how many lives. All right. Anyway.
All right. I think that's a work with author, Michael. The SMITE bill we talked about earlier.
If I could add, this was actually a bill that was brought to us by the City of Los Angeles Department of Transportation.
Which bill?
2245. This was, like I said, brought to us by the City of Los Angeles Department of Transportation. And the issue here is that bike lane projects that don't require restriping are categorically exempt from CEQA. When a bike lane requires the restriping of a street, sometimes involving the removal of a traffic lane, that triggers an environmental review. And what we want to do here is exempt a bike lane even if it requires restriping. It's something done. So, looking to support that.
That one, I think we understand. Without objection, the support position to move forward on that. 2405 Blumenfield. I'm sorry.
AB 2405 Blumenfield is a measure that would authorize the alternative fuel vehicles into the express lanes. We've been working with the Assembly Member's Office on this legislation, and I would like to change our recommendation to work with author on AB 2405. Mr. Chairman, on AB 2405, we'd like to change our recommendation to work with author.
Right.
Last year we sought a provision that would have excluded the alternative fuel vehicles from the express lanes. We're working with the Assembly Member's Office on the language because he would like us to reconsider that, and has authored the legislation to
And I understand some of the concern from some of our folks are that we want, when we start on the 110 and the 10, we want to, clean's not the right word, but we want the data, you know, we want to be able to measure the effectiveness of the carpool lane and the hot lane. And I think that's what the concern was in terms of sticker vehicles at the time.
Yes.
Okay. Diane? Your mic, please.
If I may, and my mic's not on.
No.
Okay. If I may, this is not somewhat in the future. It is when we're looking at using zero emission vehicles in the future, likely there will be electrified lanes for them, electrified in one way or another, and there will be a charge for that. In order to make it seems to me if those zero emission vehicles did not have to pay a charge to go in an express lane, that they would do that, and we would lose the efficiency of those lanes. So I think we need to keep that in consideration. It's not next year, but it's also not the next century either. So my concern is there. We need to make it attractive for folks to use the lanes, whether they be HOV lanes or other lanes, to get someplace and not give them an alternative that is cheaper to use that destroys what we're looking to accomplish.
And we're working with Assemblymember Blumenfield on language that would try and accomplish that.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Jim. All right, Michael, next.
AB 2440 is another one of our sponsored measures, and it would we call this the Metro's Customer of Choice Initiative, and what we're trying to do here is implement recommendations that have been made by various groups about reforming our procurement process. And if I could just take a little bit of time to highlight a couple of the issues that are in here for discussion purposes. The first is would modify the small purchase thresholds. There are provisions in federal law that establish bidding processes for small purchases. The first change would just change state law to be consistent with federal law on small purchases. The second would eliminate the requirement, the metro-specific requirement on a pre-qualification process. We currently have a provision that requires a pre-qualification process at Metro, but there is a statewide pre-qualification process that applies to all government agencies. So what we're looking to do here is basically follow the state law instead of the one that's specific to Metro. The next one would eliminate the specific requirement that change orders at Metro be reviewed by both county council and go through an internal audit. This is another Metro-specific requirement.
Is that Lowenthal, or is that
no? This was one that was.
Bill is this?
It goes back. I believe it was included in the Hayden bill.
No, I'm saying, but what bill is?
Oh, I'm sorry. 2440, AB 2440.
It is Lowenthal bill.
Yes.
Okay.
G.
All right. Yeah, I got Lowenthal. Move on to Garrick, please.
Excuse me.
Move on. Next one.
Okay. The next issue is best value and design build contracts, and this is a two-part change. The first would authorize the CEO to delegate to staff the decision to use design build on a procurement. Right now, we have to come back to the board to ask for permission to use design build and then bring back the actual design build procurement, and this would allow the CEO to delegate that decision to staff. That would save a couple of months on a procurement process. The other thing we do in here is change our design build statute from low bid to best value, and that would give us some flexibility, we think, in the procurement process and allow us to choose.
Okay.
Flexible. So
got it.
Support. AB 2477 by Assemblymember Garrick would clarify the law with respect to video event recorders. These are cameras on our buses. And we have a support work with author. The support is because the bill clarifies that we can place the cameras in a location in the windshield.
Who sponsored the bill?
The manufacturers. The manufacturers are doing this. The reason is because there have been some changes in federal regulations, and the state law has not reflected those. The issue is the specific location of the camera in the windshield.
Well, I'm just concerned that in what vehicles are covered in this?
It's mainly our transit buses.
Well, is it buses only?
I
need to make sure, because we have inward-facing cameras in Metrolink trains, which the union has sued us over, and they have lost every step of the way.
I'll check.
I want to make sure this isn't a backdoor attempt to undo what the courts have said. You know, we need to do for safety reasons.
I'll check with Metrolink.
All right.
The issue here is there's some language in here that has to do with providing the recordings to, and so we're dealing with that.
Right.
The last bill, SB 1225 by Senator Padilla, is our sponsored measure that would provide a local governance mechanism for the Los Angeles Quarter. And
okay. Thank you, Michael. Good to go.
Thank you.
With the changes we discussed. All right, gate locking plan, item 35.
This is a preliminary plan to review the steps involved in locking the gates. These dates are, we need to take into account Title VI. As well as any kind of ADA compliance issues, so we have to those may impact the schedule. But this is the preliminary schedule that we've established so far. Our plan is to come back to the board in April with a much more detailed plan, as well as any action items that have to take place as a result of the locking. Basically, where we are, giving an overview, is yesterday we had our first meeting, a cross-functional internal team, multidisciplinary, to identify all the different aspects of locking the gates. We met in, to identify all the issues that need to be addressed in terms of moving forward. We also are moving forward in terms of the installations on the cameras. We still have to look at the PTELs, which are the telephone system that is at the gate accessible areas. And then we also basically need to come up with an enforcement plan working with LASD, as well as an outreach plan. And so we plan on having that all complete this month. In April, we will bring back the plan to the board. and with any kind of possible actions that might need to take place, if there's any deployment impacts, if there's any fire life safety issues or contract authority issues, we would bring those forward in April. And then also any impacts to our transfer agreements or any kind of fair impacts, we would bring that forward as well, too. And again, that does have to go through Title VI review to make sure we're in compliance. And then upon approval of everything, we would basically begin our public education. The key thing, the first big customer impact would take place in May, and what that basically involves is converting our ticket vending machines, and these would be all the ticket vending machines on the entire rail system, and it's pushing or it's converting them to be tap only or tap enabled. So even before we lock the gates, we have to convert our ticket machines into tap compliance. And basically the big conversion there are the day passes as well as the one-way tickets. And what this means is that no paper products would come out of our ticket machines, including interagency transfers. And also it means that people who get reduced fare, seniors, they would actually have to have the reduced fare tap card in order to interact with the or achieve the discounts from the ticket machines. Again, just so that'll have a big customer impact in terms of modifying those ticket machines. And again, we plan to do a big educational push as we move forward on that. In June, our goal is to have both the Easy Transit Pass as well as MetroLink passes tap enabled. So we're working with that. There's a separate group that there's actually a report on later addressing the Easy Pass and the regional issues. And I'm meeting with MetroLink this afternoon to discuss their plans going forward. And the goal is to begin implementation in July of locking. It would be an incremental implementation. We're envisioning the first station to be locked with Normandy, very similar to our testing program. We would come up with a configuration of how we would operate that, which would basically be a combination of LASD personnel as well as outreach personnel, primarily training people on how to use the ticket machines. And the goal is to identify the optimal staffing level, so as we move forward, we would adjust based on customer needs. And the basic concept there is as customers become more acclimated to the lock gate environment, we would require less resources to man the gates, basically, operate the gates in a locked environment. August through December, we would continue the implementation, so we would move incrementally through locking gates as we go forward. And our goal is by November to have the complete subway locked. From that point forward, we would basically evaluate the overall program, figure out what the revenue impacts are, the cost impacts, basically what the results of everything are. Because and the reason why we would stop on the subway, which is the red and the purple line, is because that's a fully gated environment. The access there is walled off or gated off. So that is a preliminary plan. We'll have greater details as we move forward and as the different departments weigh in on what is required. Some of the things we have to look at are technical things like switching in the stations, fire life safety compliance in terms of the alarm gates, the fire life safety gates that are on some of the fencing arrays. So there are some detailed issues that we'll bring forward as they as we identify them. And that concludes my report, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. We have one public comment. Sorry.
Great. So the Transit Coalition has issued its comments by email regarding the gate locking. And we, of course, respect the concern that board members such as Supervisor Jaroslawski have expressed regarding making sure that fare evasion is not costing the agency money. At the same time, we also want to make sure that decisions are not made based on a misperception of the amount of lost revenue. As Deputy CEO Paul Taylor has said, it's less than 5% of the ridership that may potentially be engaging in fare evasion. The most accurate measure is what the sheriffs have measured on random checks on subways. We have several outstanding concerns, one of which is to make sure that cyclists are not blocked from entering portals that do not have ADA compliant gates. We also want an answer with regard to why, from a technical level, interagency transfers cannot be issued from TVMs going forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Matt, thank you. Civil rights compliance update, Dan. And the other was LRB.
Good morning. I have another in our series of updates. Metro has provided an update to our original corrective action plan, and that was submitted when Art and I were in Washington at the beginning of the month. It includes some tweaks to the methodologies, and we provide the evidence of the completed actions that have been taken, board minutes and board reports. We've also made some minor tweaks to the schedule that we were planning. Still, all the deficiencies, or the majority of the deficiencies, are planned to be resolved by June of this year, and all of them by January 2013, which is actually 1 month later. Over the next year, we'll be concentrating in three areas: the limited English proficiency, which is the most time-consuming one, service and fair equity, and service monitoring. Service and fair equity should hopefully be wrapped up by June, and the service monitoring would start in July. On English, limited English proficiency, factor one is complete and has been sent to the FTA for their review. They've had it since probably about January. We haven't heard back from them yet. A consultant has been selected, and work is about to begin on factors two and three. And as I said, that's scheduled for completion at the end of this year. On service and fair equity, we're working on resolving deficiencies and advancing on multiple fronts, but a lot of the work has to be sequential. And, of course, all the reports and analysis has to be vetted by the FTA before coming to you. And we're still waiting for FTA approval on some of the key items. And that's part of the reason why we've moved the schedule back to accommodate the FTA approval. Specifically, there'll be a report presented this month, at the board meeting and at the committee meeting this afternoon, on the Orange Line BRT, which is 3 months earlier than we originally said in the corrective action plan. And we're also doing service changes for June, which is not an item that was in the corrective action plan. And again, that's also part of the reason why some of the other work has been pushed back. The analysis of the free fare for opening of the Orange Line Expo lines is attached to the report. Both lines are being traded the same. The Expo line serves a minority area, and the Orange Line extension serves a non-minority area. And they both have the free fare for 1 day prior to regular public opening. On service and fair equity, things that are underway, we have submitted to the FTA for approval the consultant scope of work for the analysis of the regional connector, the West Side Subway, and the Crenshaw LAX transit corridor, and again, we're waiting for FTA approval to be able to move forward with that. The same scope will be used for Foothill and Expo 2, but those projects, we're finding out, are going to be a little bit more complicated because much of the data that we need to do the work has to be provided by construction authorities, and it will push that back to January 2013. On fair equity, or service and fair equity, we are doing an equity analysis of the 2010-2011 service changes, and we'll bring that to you in May of 2012, a little bit later than we thought originally, but again, just to allow for FTA approvals. And then the fare changes, because we moved the service change one back, we have to move the fare change back as well, so it goes to June of this year, and still no change to the end of the year fiscal target. In terms of service monitoring, the FTA found deficiencies with the existing monitoring program, so we've implemented, we're implementing a new communications program to resolve the past problems, and then a new quantitative monitoring program is being developed for implementation. Originally we said in June, but it really starts with the new fiscal year, so July 1st, just a minor adjustment on that. The FTA has promised to send a trainer to LA so that courses could be offered for Metro as well as all the other regional and municipal operators in Southern California. Just reviewing quickly and schedule.
Okay, I'm going to try to ask you to wrap it up because we're going to lose a quorum here.
Okay. Well, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Are there any questions? I appreciate the report. We have two people who want to be heard on this, Sun Young Yang and Eric Roman.
Good morning, board members. We just want to point specifically the attention of the board members to two areas of where FDA found major deficiencies around past service cuts and around service monitoring. Specifically, we don't understand why, if there were disparities between the experience of riders of color and white riders identified, why the response is to just do a marketing campaign rather than to actually improve service to close the disparity in the material experience of riders, number one. We also want to point to the fact that later today, the operations committee, then next week at the board, the general board meeting, the board is being asked to approve a transit service policy, which appears to include important components of the corrective action plan without FTA approval. And in fact, the most current drafts of those policies have not been made available to the public, maybe not to the board either. So we just urge you to exercise extreme caution, and we've communicated these concerns as well to the FDA. Thank you.
Thank you. Sun Young Yang.
Good morning, committee members. I'm here to also raise similar concerns around, I think, the what appears to be a very peachy report on the progress of the civil rights compliance update is not actually what's all we think is being considered. We actually met with Administrator Peter Rogoff at the end of February, raising the concerns around the evidence that was made in the finding around the discriminatory impact service cuts that was shown in your own analysis, and that constitutes the fact that you guys, this board, went forward with those cuts knowing that it was a discrimination, that those service cuts will lead to discrimination, is actually a violation of civil rights law, not just the process of the Title VI circular. So, you know, we know that the FTA is deliberating on that piece, and we ask this board to pay a lot more attention to the civil rights compliance, and we know for a fact that there's plenty of evidence of violation. The only right thing for this agency to do is to mandate the remedy and the restoration of the million hours that you've cut.
Thank you. All right. This is just a receive and file report. This point, without objection, so ordered. Do we have any other items? Okay, are these reports? Okay. Is there any? All right. Can we have 37 and 51 done? Very, very abbreviated, in a very abbreviated way.
Good morning. I'm Karen Gorman. I'm here with Jack Shikitomi from the Inspector General's office, and we are here to present a report from the Inspector General's office concerning Expo, Gold Line, and the Alameda Corridor East Construction Authority.
Hang on a second. What is that noise? Somebody's buzzer is going off? Oh, okay. Go ahead, Karen.
Thank you. Sorry. In December, the board asked us to review the staffing levels, CEO compensation, travel policies of those construction authorities. Following the board's directive to do that, I met with all the CEOs of those agencies. And we obtained information that was required by the motion and the verification documentation concerning that information. And we've placed it in a report to the board that you've received today. We included some recommendations and conclusions about what had taken place. The incidents that I think initiated the motion by the board was a news report concerning the Gold Line. Immediately following that news report, the Gold Line modified its internal travel policies. So we looked at those new policies And we still had some additional recommendations as to ways they could firm up those policies.
Are these recommendations largely focused around the travel policies?
They focus around travel policies, transparency, ways in which they can make their websites better with financial information, staffing information, compensation information, and those sorts of things. We've included the recommendations in the report on pages 11 and 12, I believe. The good news is that we've heard back from all of the three authorities who have all agreed to make modifications to some degree concerning their policies, concerning their transparency. ACE has even asked us over. I've had a meeting with their CEO who would like to post OIG posters at construction sites, add the OIG hotline to their website, and ask us to receive complaints that come in that have to do with Metro's monies to protect Metro's resources and let people report to them. So we've received positive input from all of the three construction authorities in response to our report, and they've already taken action.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Antonovich.
First, I want to commend Karen for this report. You did a very, very good job.
Thank you.
Some of the questions I have is why did the CEO for Expo receive a $25,000 bonus in 2011 when the project is over budget and behind schedule? Mm-hmm.
Those determinations are made in closed session based on the performance objectives that are set for that CEO, and made that board determines whether or not that CEO has met his objectives independent of the status of the project itself, I believe. So so I can't respond beyond that to you, sir.
Just interesting, because I just read an article, a motion that my colleague is going to be introducing at a subsequent meeting that talks about needing for standards and performance review, and it just follows Mel's motion that's going to be coming at his committee meeting. The Cal Expo
can I answer your question if you're really interested in the answer to the question?
I am.
He did not get a bonus last year. He forwent it, and in his evaluation, that was a determination that was made. So he may have been paid a bonus in 2011 that may have gone back to 2010, but he has not gotten a bonus for this past year. Okay. And he is rigorously evaluated every year, and the bonuses are established. There are benchmarks. If he reaches the benchmarks, and by the way, he was entitled to the bonus this year, and he gave it up.
What's interesting is he makes $334,000 plus, and the CEO of the MTA makes $310,000, and the CEO for the County of Los Angeles is $338,000 plus.
What is the CEO of the Gold Line?
I am going to get to the Gold Line next. So, first, we do the Expo Line. And then the question is, Expo turned in documentation at the last minute. In your subsequent review of those documents, did everything check out?
Pretty much so. We appreciate them providing those documents, even though they came a little bit late to us. We've been looking at those. We might have a question or two to converse with them about, but we don't think we need any further information from them. We think we have substantial information, and I wouldn't recommend that we ask them for any more information, but we'll work with them on those couple of questions that we might have as a result of what they provided to us.
In your review of the Goal Line contract, what were the performance milestones available for the CEO to meet and earn a 5% bonus per milestone, which equates to about $15,000 per milestone achieved?
There's 12 milestones that were created in mid-2007 that he has to complete by the end of 2016. I believe he's completed at least one of those, because I believe he got a bonus in 2010. I'm not sure how many of the other tasks he's completed yet, but I think he still has most of those ahead of him.
How is it possible that he was able to earn 66 days of vacation time a year and then had the option to cash out that vacation time at an additional compensation? And what is the value of those 66 days per year if they were all cashed out every year? So how much compensation would that be?
I haven't done the math on that, sorry. I'm not as good as Director Yaroslavsky on quick math. But if you take divide his salary by the number of days he works. Each day is worth so much, and you calculate them. He earns that many days according to his, I guess, contract. It's in his contract that that's how many days he earns. So I don't know. I know he cashed out some vacation that amounted to about $90,000, but I don't know if that was 66 or if that was accumulation. I don't remember the math in my head. Pardon?
That's pensionable?
I don't think so, not that I'm aware of.
No, on page 6 of your review, it says the CEO compensation and certain benefits for the goal line is $452,185, for Expo, $474,446, and the ACE is $272,373. But how do we make the IG recommendations for transparency and accountability mandatory for these construction authorities for them to receive funding from MTA?
Well, mandatory, let's see. We do have some provisions in our MOUs with them that do allow us to audit them, and so we can look at them annually and make those recommendations to them. We do have representatives from our board on their boards, and I think our representatives, you know, can carry the water for us in that regard to help us with that. And when you thankfully asked us to do this report, just making it transparent, this information, they are doing the right thing, I think, and responding to us positively to implement those. We can follow up with them if you wish to see, you know, what happens and let you know.
What is the compensation for MTA's head of construction?
I didn't look at that, but it's less, obviously,
much
than
less.
Me, but sure, of course.
The motion I have... The Inspector General's report on the salaries, reporting practices, transparency related to three independent construction authorities, the Expo Metro Line Authority, the Metro GO Line Foothill Construction Authority, and the Alameda Corridor East Construction Authority, providing recommendations on how each authority could improve its policies and level of transparency to make agencies more accountable to MTA and the public on its spending public funds, including Measure R dollars. So I'd move that the MTA Board request the Expo and Metro Line Construction Authority, the Metro GO Line Foothill Extension Construction Authority, and the Alameda Corridor East Construction Authority to implement the recommendations made by the Inspector General in this report within 45 days. And should those recommendations not be implemented within that time frame, the MTA CEO would bring to our board recommendations on how the board the board of the Metropolitan Transit Authority could make implementation of these recommendations mandatory for each authority, which is a recipient of Measure R and other monies controlled by the MTA. So that'd be the motion.
Is there any objection? If not, we'll recommend it to the board.
Very good.
Without objection. All right. Next item.
Thank you.
Thank you. The last item is item 50. Is it 51?
Remember, Nalini, the chair asked that we do it promptly, quickly.
Sure.
Yeah. Very abbreviated.
This is just a quick update to a response by the motion to move TAP forward as a regional program. We have set up a working group of transit operators. We did have a first meeting last month, and we plan to meet every 3 weeks. We have made some progress in the Easy Pass area. We are going to proceed with a hybrid Easy tap card, and we'll try to dovetail the schedule with the gate locking schedule that we just saw with Matt. He mentioned June. We may go into July. We still have to work out a lot of details, but with that, I'd like Art Ida, he's the chair of the General Managers Group, to give some more details.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Art Ida. I'm transportation director with Culver City Bus. I'm also the chair of the General Managers Group as well as the LACMOA Group, which represents all the 14 municipal operators in Los Angeles County. And I want to first thank your support for bringing this working group together. We are very interested in moving the TAP program to be a regional.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, move to receive and file.
There's what?
Receive and file?
Yes. You're moving to receive and file? Without,
I want you to know, I've read it. I know that
we've all had an opportunity to read it.
Yeah. That all of the, I commend you for doing this because I think all the operators need to be a part of the TAP. But I've also heard the chair ask a couple times to keep things brief, so that's why the receive and file motion.
I think the report's a good one, and I think it's a work in progress. And if you can keep us posted on that at the next meeting, appreciate it. Without objection, will be received and filed. Is there any other business before the committee? Then we are adjourned.